6:05 here on a Thursday. Good to have you.
Friday Eve.
Yeah, Friday
Yay!
Eve. Lloyd Jackson, good morning.
Good morning, sir.
We are going to have a beautiful day today.
Yeah, we are.
We might see some rain, maybe a possible storm later on.
A pop-up, and it's not going to be like widespread. It's going to be like, you know, hit or miss. Some people will get it, some people won't.
Yeah, and this is still while DTE is trying to put a couple people back online.
And those 90s are going to return next week.
Yes. So. We're almost touching 90 today.
I know.
I think it's like 80, mid-80s.
We almost touched it yesterday, too.
And we almost touched it. It was high yesterday.
It was hot yesterday. Yeah.
Meanwhile, did you watch the GOP gubernatorial debate on Fox 2 last night?
I did.
What'd you think?
Well, I don't... You know, I don't feel like I really learned anything. They went after each other a lot without really telling me what they were going to do. And, you know, the format was a little different where the question was asked. They get a minute to answer. But in that answer, if they invoke the name of one of their opponents, then when the opponent responds, they get an extra 30 seconds. So it's a minute and 30 seconds. And so it was a lot of that going on. I don't know. I just didn't feel I learned a lot.
To me, it was more about mudslinging. It was more about trying to tear the other two candidates down as opposed to propping up what you think. And look, to be fair, there were a number of instances in which they talked about the state income tax and doing away with that and where that money would go.
Education because you're talking about
tens of billions of dollars that go towards the state budget that come directly from income taxes. So where does that come from?
And reforming the MEDC. You heard a lot about that as well.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Accusations thrown against Donald Trump about his, you know, father growing and starting a business that he inherited.
Yes.
And Mike Cox not having won an elected office in quite some time since he was attorney general.
According to John James, before the iPhone.
Before the which is actually factually true.
Is that true? Okay.
The iPhone came out in 2007.
Okay.
And Perry Johnson talked about, like, ChatGPT coming up with this 4747
Exactly.
So, it didn't feel incredibly productive.
Yeah.
Now,
I agree.
You got to be there.
No.
All three
and people
want
to hear from their candidates.
Yes. And John, it sounds like John James left afterwards when there were opportunities to...
Like a spin room?
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
John James left a little early. Mike Cox and Perry Johnson did stay around for questions from reporters.
Okay.
And then there was also these questions from the audience.
Yes.
Which I thought was interesting. And they... What Roop Raj has described it as, this was a group of conservatives or independents, people that would likely vote for
one of the three.
Yeah. Or at least as an independent, consider one of the three.
Sure.
And Andrea Bightley had asked a question. Jamie Rowe, friend of the show, had asked a question as well.
Mm-hmm.
So you had some folks that have ties to the game that were involved in this too. But it just felt like there was certainly a piling on of John James.
Oh, they were, and they kind of both kind of teamed up on him at times.
Absolutely. Yeah. Why? Well, because he's the, at least in the public's view, seems to be the front runner.
Well, in some polling
show
as
it.
Well. Plus, he has
he's got the money,
and he's got the backing of the president,
and he's got the endorsement of Donald Trump.
Yeah.
So and which also got brought up.
Sure.
He had the endorsement of Donald Trump during his two Senate campaigns as well, and lost.
Yeah.
So. It didn't feel incredibly productive. I'm with you.
Yeah, I just didn't feel like I learned any more than I already know from commercials and things of that nature.
We're going to talk to Mike Cox in the 7 o'clock hour at 7:35. John James will join us tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
As well.
Yes.
Meanwhile, thankfully, they brought somebody into custody in this 5-year-old shooting.
Yeah, let's get an update on that. A 15-year-old boy is in custody following that shooting of the 5-year-old on Detroit's West Side. Police say the young boy was riding his bicycle with his father at the Fargo Oakville playground around 9 Tuesday night when gunfire erupted. The child struck in the arm, reportedly by a bullet fired into the air. At a community event yesterday, Detroit Police Chief Todd Bettison announced the teen suspect is being held at a juvenile detention facility. Bettison credited tips from the public for the quick arrest, calling the community and police an unbeatable team. The 5-year-old is recovering, said to be in good spirits. No official charges have been announced yet as that investigation
continues. And the police had said they knew that this young boy was someone who frequented the neighborhood. So once that happened, I'm sure the neighborhood knew who this young person was, and it was just a matter of time.
The war in Iran seems to be back on. U.S. CENTCOM confirmed that U.S. forces struck more than 90 targets in Iran, which they say will further degrade Tehran's ability to attack commercial shipping vessels and civilian mariners in the Strait of Hormuz. They said U.S. forces struck approximately 90 Iranian targets, including air defense systems, coastal surveillance assets, missiles and drone storage sites, naval capabilities, and military logistics infrastructure along Iran's coastline. And this comes as Donald Trump had basically said, you know, the MOU is done, the ceasefire is done, as far as he was concerned. They were going to still try to negotiate, but, and he even said yesterday, we'll probably attack him pretty hard tonight.
And looking at oil, I mean, oil is $73.62 a barrel. Brent is $78.20. It was below $70 just a few days ago. But now, since this escalation, those prices have started to go up.
Despite all of this, Donald Trump says that Iran wants to make a deal.
We've already won militarily. They have very little. They have very little left, and they want to make a deal so badly. They called a little while ago. They want to make a deal so badly. I just don't know if they're worthy of making a deal. I don't know that they're going to honor the deal. That's the problem.
I mean, again, we've heard this before.
Yeah.
From the president, that Iran wants to make a deal. And yet, here we are.
And I agree with him that, you know, they want to, if that's the deal and they want to make a deal, you can't trust that they'll keep it if you make a deal.
Well,
with them.
Again, it's the rhetoric, too.
Yeah.
If the president says this thing's over and we're going to attack, then you got to do that.
Uh-huh.
Now, it's probably not the best strategy because you're tipping your hand.
Yeah.
But at the same time, at some point, you got to step up. And if they're not willing to make that deal, which he alluded to earlier this week, he alluded to that in Turkey.
He did.
Which is, you know, they say one thing behind closed doors, then they get out in front of it, and it's not at all what we talked about.
No.
And they just keep kicking the can down the road. And so the president just said, look, you're going to attack these vessels in the strait, then we're done here. And then Bahrain and Kuwait gets hit again.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So it feels like we are in a cycle.
It does.
It feels like we're in a cycle here. And that's a problem.
Speaking of the president, he will ask the U.S. Supreme Court to reconsider its ruling blocking his effort to restrict birthright citizenship, a move legal experts say is unlikely to succeed. The Supreme Court rejected the president's executive order last month, ruling it conflicted with the 14th Amendment, which grants citizenship to people born in the United States who are subject to the jurisdiction thereof. Trump called the decision a miscarriage of justice and said he plans to immediately seek a rehearing. The Supreme Court rarely agrees to rehear cases after issuing a decision, and it has not done so in a fully argued case in decades. Trump issued the executive order on his first day back in office as part of a broader effort to change immigration policy. So we'll see. I mean, you know, there is precedent that they have done it, but it's been decades since they have. So we'll see.
Meanwhile, Justin Verlander, an all-star once again.
Yes, but also going to be a retiree.
Yeah. Well, he was a legend pick from Commissioner Rod Manfred, because you're probably thinking, on what grounds is Justin Verlander an all-star in this 2026 season? He's pitched one game and he's been injured.
Never. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I was gonna say his ERA is low. He hasn't pitched.
Well, that's true. That's fair. Well, didn't he give up like 5 runs in that game? I don't think his ERA is very good.
Yeah.
But he is a legend pick. So he will represent the Tigers at the All-Star game. And then minutes later, he released his retirement letter on social media, and he basically said, "The season's challenged me. I never even really dreamed of retiring. I always wanted the game to tell me when it was time to retire." And he says, "Now that time has come."
Yeah. Hmm.
And I probably agree. I don't think his body is responding quite the way that he would have liked.
Listen, I know Verlander wanted to rock it till the wheels fall off, man.
It's amazing, like a Max Scherzer. You know, Max Scherzer has got so many miles that he's still pitching.
It's unbelievable.
You know?
Yeah.
Because those guys have pitched in the postseason so much throughout in their career.
For sure. 3-time Cy Young winner, AL MVP in 2011, the Triple Crown winner in 2011, won 2 World Series with Houston. He's a 10-time All-Star, 2-time ERA title holder. I mean, he is.
I mean, come on, man. You've done a lot.
Destined for Cooperstown, but.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. It's it feels like the end of an era a little bit. Like,
it does.
All those must see JV days here in Detroit. And, you know, it's unbelievable.
Well, I'm thinking, heck of a career. Did he, you know, was he already thinking about it? And then when this legend pick came, he just said, hey, that's my cue.
Could be. Meanwhile, the DOJ says they're sending election monitors to Michigan. Talk about that next. It's JR Morning. So the U.S. Department of Justice has informed Michigan election officials that it plans to send federal election monitors to three different Michigan cities for these upcoming elections. It includes Detroit, Lansing, and East Lansing. Now, according to reports, it comes as the administration's Department of Justice and this federal authority to observe election procedures and to ensure compliance with federal voting rights laws is done properly. And this comes, you know, when Detroit has been certainly a focal point of election allegations in the past. Let's talk about it with Peter J. Hammer, the faculty director of the Damon J. Keith Center for Civil Rights and professor of law at Wayne State University's Law School. Professor, it's great to have you.
Good morning.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the legal authority here. Does the DOJ have the legal authority to place these election monitors in local polling locations?
Yeah, so the first biggest thing is to know that states run elections, right? And so the actual mechanics of elections are state-controlled, not federal-controlled. Second thing to know is that the DOJ can do almost anything it wants, so it can send election monitors as long as they stay in their lane.
If Michigan believes the federal government is overstepping its authorities, does the state have any legal recourse? Could it stop the DOJ?
Yeah, no, the federal government can easily overstep. Asking for information doesn't have a right to have. It can ask to be in places it shouldn't be. It could ask to do things it can't do. And if it oversteps its authority, because I said, what lane are you in? Then the state can go to federal court. And there's amazing organizations such as the Michigan ACLU that will be watching them. There's going to be a lot of control over what they're trying to do.
And what can they do? How do they differ from like a normal poll watcher?
Yeah, and I want to put this in a slightly different context. And people may disagree with me, so I'm going to say this is my opinion. My opinion is that we are really in a democratic crisis. And I don't say that with a big D, but a small D. And that we are really facing a president that's trying to consolidate authoritarian power. So if you look at it from that lens, then sending election monitors means very different than if it were done by George W. Bush. So I think what we're really going to have, and we should be ready for this, is that the election monitors are a signal of something even more serious. You could imagine all sorts of attempts to undermine the midterm elections.
You know, the DOJ chose Detroit and it chose Lansing and East Lansing, which are all heavily Democratic communities. Does the selection of those cities raise any constitutional or legal concerns, or is that primarily a political issue?
Yeah, so first off, constitutional concerns this president doesn't care about, right? So he's not going to be limited by the Constitution, which is really sad. But the choice of Detroit is obvious. He hates Detroit. Detroit is going to be on the top list of about 10 different cities. They're going to be targeted under the midterm attack on democracy.
I'm curious to know then what this does for voters. Is there concern? You mentioned the people that will be watching the federal election monitors. Is there a concern that this will dissuade people from voting?
This is a really interesting psychological question. At one level, yeah, you don't want to go there and be intimidated. But if you look at it from the perspective of African-American history, poll watchers are a lot less than the Ku Klux Klan and Mississippi and 1885. So there's a way in which this could backfire on the president's attempt, because tell people they can't vote, they're going to vote, right? And so there's a way in which, depending on how it's interpreted, it could actually, in the light of sort of a long history of the fight for democracy, actually be a motivator for many people to say, you're not going to tell me I can't vote.
If this professor dispute winds up, let's say, in court, what do you think would be the central legal question judges would have to answer?
It depends on whether this becomes abusive or not. If they just come up and play poll watcher, that's okay. And that's not a bad thing. I think it's a bad thing that they do it politicized. But we should have a lot of people watching our elections. So I'm not against anybody watching elections. It's whether they overstep, right? And the question then will be what kind of overstep they're taking will present the particular legal challenge that will be made.
Peter J. Hammer, thank you for your time this morning. We appreciate it.
All right. Take care.
Yeah, you too. It's interesting. That is a much dour look on what this actually could be. Now, the point of these three communities being heavily Democratic, I think, is notable.
Absolutely.
Certainly. Mm-hmm. I guess my perspective is, if we're running elections properly, then who cares if there are federal election monitors there?
Absolutely.
What's the difference?
Yeah.
If you've got election observers, you've got challengers, you've got poll watchers, and now you've got election monitors, what's the difference?
If you're doing it right, it shouldn't be no issue, right?
It's a couple other people in the room.
Yeah.
And that's my point, is that's fine. I don't necessarily take the approach or the viewpoint of the professor. I think that's a much more doom and gloom approach.
But I do think in this climate that we are in, that it could chill people from voting.
I don't think I understand. That's why I asked the question, because I think people do feel that way.
Yeah.
And I don't know how that's possible, because first of all, again, you've got so many different challengers and watchers there.
Mm-hmm.
If you were concerned about that, then they would be doing the same thing. An election, these DOJ election monitors aren't going to be out there pressuring people not to vote. They're going to be watching what's happening.
No, but we don't know what they're going to do yet.
Well,
they're not supposed to do that.
But their role is not outside.
Exactly. No.
In terms of dissuading people from standing in line to vote, I just don't think that that's there's any warrant to that.
Well, some people just may not even show up. It's like, oh, I'm not going to.
I suppose that could be.
You know, you have people there. I don't know. You know, I'm not going to do it. So yeah. I don't know.
Frontier Airlines filling a gap left by Spirit. We'll talk about it next. It's JR Morning. Well, artificial intelligence has certainly shifted cyber threats and shifting the balance between offensive capabilities and defensive controls. And that continues to be the focus and a real problem as these things continue to develop.
Mm-hmm.
And so what is being done about it? Let's talk about it. Gregory Laidlaw is the Department Chair of Cybersecurity Information Systems at the University of Detroit. It's great to have you.
Good morning. Great to be here.
So let's talk about what kind of hacking skills is AI making more possible for those bad actors?
Really, it's giving them a lot more power and a lot more reasoning, where previous attacks had to be done by humans and a lot by hand and a lot of reasoning and a lot of smart but somewhat evil people putting together very complex plans and attacks. Now AI can do a bunch of this all on its own. And the article we're referencing talks about how much faster it can do it and how much better that it can do than all about the most skilled hackers. So it's the ability to put together multiple areas of weakness in a piece of software and just keep pushing and pushing and pushing and pushing. And AI is spectacular at that. And doesn't get tired, doesn't need to sleep, doesn't need to eat.
You know, Gregory, one of the concerns is that AI systems aren't just answering questions anymore. I mean, they're planning, they're adapting, they're solving problems. Does that make them more capable of launching these sophisticated cyber attacks?
Well, they wouldn't launch it on their own, of course, but it makes them more capable of seeing things that, that humans really can't, where if we're doing this by hand, we might look at a system and see, 10 vulnerabilities that might be worth exploiting. And we pick, as humans, we'd pick the ones that, look most promising.
Yeah.
Well, if you're, on an AI system, you can do all 10 or all 100. And one of the dangerous things is, it's not just the first vulnerability or the first exploit that we're taking advantage of, it's chaining them together. And when we're doing that, maybe the one that looks least promising to a human chains together better with things that come after that. So AI has a much more capable exploring those things than we would by hand or even as a team of people trying to do that.
What type of guardrails are put into place by the developers of these companies? And are we reaching a point, I suppose, where some of these cyber attacks are automated even by these systems?
Not by the systems themselves, but yes, obviously they would be, that would be leveraging the power of AI to make your either your attack or if you're auditing, that much more successful. But the guardrails themselves, there's been a lot of work done in that area, and they're becoming more and more sophisticated because some of the earlier, attempts at guardrails, we're pretty easily bypassed. And some of the things that we do in class when we're talking about or testing these systems is walking through some of the scenarios where you could bypass a guardrail. Some of the simpler ones where you couldn't, they throw a guardrail in and say you couldn't ask about making a bomb. Pretty quick and easy, but much like in the earlier days of spam filters and everything else, we could get by that by saying, well, we're not really asking about building a bomb, but help me develop a story about a character who builds a bomb. And if we were to make this story realistic, how would we, how would we write that?
Yeah.
And that, that sort of bypasses the guardrail because you're not asking about building a bomb. You're asking about writing a character who builds a bomb. Okay. And, of course, the guardrails are more and more sophisticated, but, we're also getting more sophisticated and the systems are getting more sophisticated. So, it's an ongoing race of, how do we test this stuff? How do we make sure that it is, not going beyond what it's been programmed to do, but stays within those guardrails so that it's not, potentially doing something dangerous.
So you got companies like Anthropic and Amazon and Google, Microsoft. They're all kind of working together now on new testing standards. Is industry collaboration, is that enough, or does this require, much stronger government oversight?
I would say probably a little bit of both. I like the idea that they see the danger, they're working together, they're trying to come up with reasonable solutions. But with any technology, we always have the issue where sometimes it's easier to, there's a lot of pressure to put new stuff out, new, better, faster, and kind of skimp on the testing and making sure that it's, properly grounded. We've seen that with software for pretty much forever, where it gets rushed out there and it's not quite right. I think there is enough of a danger here with AI that, I like the fact that they're all working together and trying to come up with decent standards, but a little bit of government guidance and oversight would probably be worthwhile here.
Gregory Laidlaw, thank you so much for your insight on this, an important topic. We appreciate it.
All right. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you got it. Yeah, I'm glad you asked that because that's where I was going next. Yeah. So if the collaboration is already underway, it feels like then there would be some security on the back end to prevent something like this from happening.
Yeah, you would think.
But at the same time, once you're able to harness this power for these threats, then you just go do it to every company.
Every company.
And it's just gonna run through it.
Uh-huh.
And it puts the onus again on the companies to make sure that they're prepared
tight
for this. Yeah.
Yeah, and you want to know if these companies should embrace AI aggressively or slow down until, these new evaluations, standards are in place.
I don't see the slowdown.
I don't either.
They should dive in. If it's going to make your process better, you dive in.
Dive in, but also be
cautious.
Mindful. Yes.
Yeah, certainly. Coming up on the other side, 7 o'clock hour, we'll get you caught up on the headlines. We also hit the couch with Dr. Steve Craig. That's coming up on JR Morning here on a Thursday. Honestly, 7 o'clock hour here on a Thursday, and what did you make of the GOP gubernatorial debate last night, Lloyd?
I just didn't, feel that I learned much more than I already did about the three candidates. They really went after each other. they were really going after John James, each of the other opponents, sometimes both together after John James.
Which isn't uncommon when you're, you know, kind of the leader of the pack, or at least the perceived
leader of the
pack.
Absolutely. You're going to attack the one that's the so-called front runner there. But I just heard a lot about what this other person didn't do and what they didn't do this time and they didn't do this last time. And I didn't hear a lot about what I'm going to do this time. I wanted to hear more about more of that, what I'm going to do this time, rather than what my opponent didn't do last time.
Yeah, I mean, it felt like there was a ganging up too, and John James had the task of trying to navigate all of that.
He had to, yes.
And I thought he did fine. You know, I would have liked to have seen him stick around afterwards for some questions.
Yeah.
Regardless, whatever. You got to be at these debates, and everybody was there, so that was good. I thought, you know, Perry Johnson was asked a question about, you know, if Donald Trump was doing something bad for Michigan. Which is an odd question, because it feels very specific.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
when at least offer some sort of, you know, historical perspective.
Yes.
To it, and I thought so. I thought the question was a bit odd, but Perry Johnson was like, "Well, I don't know why he would do that, and if he would, we would talk it out." You know, so the Donald Trump factor in all of this certainly was covered last night too, and John James has the endorsement of the president.
Yes, definitely, and I know that's why they were on top of him and just really going after him the whole time. Also, the format to me was one, whereas a question is asked, you get a minute to answer, but in that minute, if you invoke the name of one of your opponents, then when your opponent answers the question, they get a minute, but they get an extra 30 seconds. And so it was a lot of invoking the names of the opponents. So it was a lot of minute 30s going on, you know. And then they started kind of going, talking over top of each other. And, you know, and that part I don't like either. Because you don't hear anything. You don't get anything out of that.
Sure. Yeah. And the income tax is something that everybody, for the most part, seems to need to be addressed, that they want to do away with the state income tax.
Yeah.
Perry Johnson says that'll put $4,747 in the pockets of Michigan residents, which would be a fair number. I mean, that's not an insignificant amount of money, but at the same time, well, where do you come up with that? ChatGPT. And, okay, is that realistic?
Yeah.
You know, things like that. Mm-hmm. So I'm with you. I didn't really feel like there was a ton to learn last night.
No. No, you know, I believe they're going to have another one pretty soon.
Yep.
And so we'll see if, you know, after this initial one, if they get more into the subject matter and more into the specifics and into policies more with the next debate than they did this time.
Yeah.
A Detroit tenants group is suing city's 36th district court, arguing judges are allowing landlords to collect rent and evict tenants even when rental properties lack the safety certification required under Detroit law. The lawsuit filed by the Wayne County Circuit Court contends landlords should be required to prove that they have a valid certificate of compliance before eviction cases can move forward. Currently, tenants must raise the issue themselves in court. The Detroit Tenants Union says the current system leaves renters vulnerable, especially because only about 14% of Detroit's more than 81,000 rental properties have an active certificate showing they passed city safety inspections. The group wants the court to require proof of compliance before granting eviction or rent judgments and to better inform tenants of their rights. Landlords' attorneys disagree, arguing such a policy would improperly limit judges' discretion and that existing state law already provides legal remedies for tenants. The court has declined to comment on the pending litigation.
Interesting. Meanwhile, U.S. strikes on Iran yesterday as the president makes his way back to the United States. And CENTCOM confirmed all of that. 90-plus targets of the Iranian military were hit, including air defense systems, coastal surveillance assets, missiles and drone storage sites, naval capabilities and military logistics along the Iranian coastline of the Strait of Hormuz. And this comes after Donald Trump has said, look, this deal, whatever it is over.
Yeah.
They're hitting these vessels in the Strait. Can't have that. Mm-hmm. That's a violation of the ceasefire. The United States retaliated And now Donald Trump says, look, we can negotiate, but we're
as far as
much,
I'm concerned, it's a wrap.
We're pretty much done. He says Iran wants a deal, though.
We've already won militarily. They have very little left, and they want to make a deal so badly. They called a little while ago. They want to make a deal so badly. I just don't know if they're worthy of making a deal. I don't know that they're going to honor the deal. That's the problem.
And during the press conference yesterday, the president said he was asked, you know, before, months ago, you said that these were, you know, is rational and people were ready to make a, they seemed ready to make a deal and willing to make a deal and willing to work with you.
Mm-hmm.
What's changed? Why has your perspective changed? And he said, well, I got to know them. Mm. So, again, I don't know that that has been, I think members of the administration knows what Iran's about.
Oh, yeah. You would think they
you know, and Marco Rubio behind him kind of smiled.
Yeah.
Like, well, yeah, we know who we've been dealing with.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was fascinating, too.
Just a quick update on that 5-year-old who was hit with a stray bullet yesterday while riding his bike. A 15-year-old boy is in custody following that shooting. Police say the young boy was riding his bike with his father at the Fargo Oakfield Playground on the west side of Detroit about 9 o'clock Tuesday night. When gunfire erupted, the child was struck in the arm, reportedly by a bullet fired into the air. A community event yesterday, Detroit Police Chief Todd Bettison was there announcing that the teen suspect is being held at a juvenile detention facility. Bettison credited tips from the public for that quick arrest, calling the community and police an unbeatable team. The boy is in good spirits. He's going to recover. It was a through-and-through wound to his shoulder, to his arm. Thank God for that.
Justin Verlander will be an all-star. But he also is retiring.
I mean, honestly, it's made it kind of easy. You know, here I am at the All-Star break and haven't been able to pitch except for one start. And that, you know, it started to go, you know, bad on me that start. So I think, like I said, the writing was on the wall.
Time has come.
Yes, it has.
Could be a unanimous vote
oh, yeah.
for the Hall of Fame.
Definitely.
I think it should be.
Yeah.
713, time for WDJO's Business Beat, brought to you by Shelving.com. We rock your world. Here's Jeff Sloan, the founder and CEO of Startup Nation, to spotlight the entrepreneurial, tech, and startup community on WJR.
Good morning. There's an often overlooked but highly effective marketing channel that you simply have to consider these days if you're in business. And that channel is text messaging, or SMS marketing, as it's known in the trade. In 2026, 86% of consumers opted into business text messages, and 75% of businesses say they're using SMS marketing as an effective marketing channel, showing growth from last year. Based on those statistics, among others, which I'll get to in a second, it's safe to say that texting has confirmed its place as a core channel in the marketing mix. SimpleTexting.com surveyed 1,000 consumers and 400 SMS marketers to uncover hot topics that we all want to know when it comes to whether or not text marketing works and how to best utilize it. Here are some key insights from that survey that make clear SMS marketing works indeed. Number one, 65% of businesses already using SMS marketing say they plan on increasing their budgets next year for this channel. Two, two-thirds of businesses have an average SMS marketing click-through rate of 20% or higher. Number three, customer service and support. Well, they're the most common business uses for text message marketing. How effective is it? Well, most businesses say they attribute 21 to 30% of their revenue to text message marketing. Yeah, but it only works if consumers opt in, right? Well, of course, that's true. How about this? In 2026, 86% of consumers are opted in to texts from at least one business. That's nearly a 40% growth from 2021. And 62% of consumers receive text messages they've opted in for from four or more businesses. What are the hottest categories? E-commerce, retail, healthcare, and finance are the top three categories when it comes to SMS marketing use. What are the primary uses? Appointment reservation reminders, shipment and order tracking, and promotions are the top reasons why consumers say they are willing to opt in to text messages from businesses. So there you have it, a channel you just have to try if you're in business today. I'm Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of StartupNation.com, the source for everything you need to start and grow your own business. And that's today's Business Beat on the great voice of the Great Lakes, WJR.
All right, so it's Thursday, 7:19. Dr. Steve Craig in the house. Yay! With Craig Consulting and Craig Counseling Services. What's up, Doc?
We did a little therapy on me this time.
Yeah, we did.
Thank you, guys.
Yeah, you're
welcome.
I'll send
you a bill. Welcome. Right. Today's thing. Dr. Steve, oh, this is an executive coaching thing. Dr. Steve, I have an employee who made a very bad error in January on a client project. She was working too quickly, got some numbers wrong, and it cost the company a significant amount of money. She's been with us for many years without incident, but now I'm being told by my bosses that she can't be trusted and all her work is suspect. I've been told that she should not be put on anything important because we don't know what else she will screw up and what that will cost us. My boss's stance on this is widely known in the company. It's led to the rest of her team telling her in reviews that they can't trust her. And even the workplace rumor mill is trying to connect her to long past incidents with other clients that she's not responsible for. She's always been one of our best employees, but now she's insecure and questioning her own work and is taking far too long to do things because she doesn't want to make a mistake. What do I do with this employee? I've always thought she was good, but now as her boss, I'm put in the horrible spot of basically squeezing her out and making her time here miserable. Do I give her another pep talk? Do I secretly tell her to find another job? Do I ignore my bosses, putting my own job at risk if they find out or if she makes a mistake? How do we recover? How do I and my employee recover from a horrible mistake? Go, Lloyd.
For me, I mean, listen, we know with companies, you know, the money is a big deal. You don't want to lose any money. And to me, if the company felt like it was such a mess up, you would have thought they would have let her go. But this person has been strong over the years, and I just don't think you are defined forever. You shouldn't be defined forever for, you know, a mistake. We're all human. I think you hold her accountable, but you give her a path to do better and to rebuild that trust. And I have been a manager, and I had a person in my team who made a mistake. And yeah, I held that person accountable, but we talked and I kind of checked in with her and, you know, a little coaching and those types of things. And, you know, I just think people improve when they're supported and not when, you know, they're treated at like they'll never succeed again. And I think the person that was on my team, I supported them. They got better and I didn't, you know, I didn't have to watch them that closely anymore because they knew what they did. They did better. And so I just think you just coach this person and give them some type of support and help them improve.
We support you, Lloyd.
I appreciate that. I remember that mistake I made.
I feel like there's information missing here. Okay, one bad mistake cost the company a bunch of money. But her track record has been good.
Yeah.
So it feels like as her boss or the leader of this group, it feels like that there would be, I don't know that his job would be at stake to say, well, hold on, wait a second. She's been really good over the past, you know, X amount of years or whatever it is.
Sure.
Why are we focusing on this one issue? Yes, it cost us a bunch of money. Yes, it shouldn't have happened. I'm going to make sure that we don't do that again.
Yeah.
I'm going to make sure that we're going to, I'm going to let her do her thing. And then we're going to go back and make sure that everything's copacetic. We're going to make sure things are right.
Yeah.
Something feels a little off here, whether this is truly her first mistake or whether
it was so bad
the,
that
the
they
leadership
just...
is overreacting.
Yeah.
I'd like to make a mistake around here with you guys because you guys are awesome. Well, I think this is a...
This is why we're not in charge of anybody. Exactly.
So they all be messed up. Okay, go ahead.
I don't think this is an employee problem. This is a company culture problem. Okay. Because, well, I two things that's... First of all, this is both true what I'm going to say in both personally in our relationships and professionally.
Okay.
But... There's two things here going on that really get to me, really get under my skin here. First of all, it's these insecure, immature people like to throw out these platitudes, these empty platitudes and bravados, things like once a thief, always a thief,
mm-hmm.
or somebody makes a mistake.
Yeah.
That, you know,
you're doomed forever.
The quarterback has a bad game in the playoffs and he can't handle the pressure.
That's right.
But one thing, as you said, Lloyd, never defines you, you know, and but people love to, boy, they get up on their horse for that sort of thing. Like, that's a brilliant thing to say, that someone's mistake reveals their character. But I think, no. Everyone makes mistakes. How you handle people's mistakes reveals your character.
Absolutely.
And that's what's going on here. There's some culture of, oh, my God, someone made a mistake. What are we going to do? And just for they're forever damned. That's a bad culture. So then you hit my second point, which is that we always want people to take accountability. You know, they accept the blame when they do something wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But blame without boundaries is really abuse. It's abusive. And this is what's happening here, is that because you make one mistake, we have to have a boundary on that. I made this, you know, the alphabet. I made a mistake on A doesn't mean you get to blame me for the whole alphabet. Right.
Yeah.
You have to have a boundary. So people love to then go back to my point. You made a mistake. You're damned for everything you do. That's just unacceptable, and that's a mistreat of people. But same thing in your life. You screw up something.
Well, and
at
that
home,
can't be good for business either.
Can't be good for business. But take that to your personal life. Could you imagine if you screw up anything in your marriage, in your life, and you know now because you did that?
I can't imagine it. I know. I literally, I have no idea what you're talking about.
But
yeah.
All right, Fox 2 held the GOP gubernatorial debate last night. John James, Perry Johnson, and Mike Cox all got involved. And Mike Cox joins us this morning to talk about it. It's good to have you back.
Thank you, sir. It's good to be back with you guys.
How did things go for you last night, do you feel?
You know, I wish we could have went maybe an hour and a half or two hours. Most of the debates, you know, there was 10 debates before today's, sponsored by the state party. Most of them went an hour and a half to 2 hours, and we got more time to actually talk about policy.
You know, the debate became very, you know, confrontational at times. You and Perry Johnson, you know, going after John James. Was that necessary to draw a contrast, or do you worry voters get tired of political fighting?
Lloyd, it is necessary to draw a contrast. The reality is, like many families, my family, so many families in Michigan have been impacted by outsourcing. And he may not like to admit it or not, but John James outsources American jobs. He imported, and we did a press conference. WJR was there. We gave details, bills of lading from a computer website, Import Genius. Import, not export, Import Genius, where we outlined 920 imports of auto parts made here in the Midwest that came from China that John James's family makes money off. They're $1 billion-a-year company, Lloyd. This is, you know, unfortunately, the media isn't as big as it used to be. So there isn't a whole lot of coverage on the fact that he's been an outsourcer. There's not a whole lot of coverage on a whole lot of things many of the candidates say. And so candidates say things unchecked until they get to debate. And, you know, at the end of the day, these issues we talked about last night aren't big secrets in the sense that Jocelyn Benson's team knows that he got $2 million from the MEDC and didn't pay it back. Jocelyn Benson's team knows that he goes around, running around attacking data centers. But John James, some of his biggest donors are built data centers, and he owned data center stock. In fact, it's public knowledge when he got tagged for not reporting stock trades, the so-called Nancy Pelosi Act, that a number of the stocks were Alphabet, Google, Amazon, Apple, NVIDIA, all those that are trying to build data centers. I wish we could focus more on what I have at my website, MyTalks 2026, the reasons I got into the race, which was the Fix Michigan's education so that kids – where I live in Livonia, you can get the education my grandkids are getting in Mississippi and, you know, the ways to fix the economy. But some of that relies on, quite frankly, on media reporters reporting on facts.
I'm with you. I wish there was a little more substance last night as well, and it certainly would have helped if it was a longer format. But you did talk about the special session of the legislature that you would call to eliminate the state income tax. There were education reforms that you'd like to see put in place to improve our school systems here in Michigan, which you just mentioned. How important are those in building Michigan back to where we should be as a top 10 state population-wise, but not in the education system?
You know, you don't solve the population problem until you solve the education and economy problem. You know, where my granddaughters go to school, and just for your listeners, it's called the Mississippi Miracle. Over the past 12 years, they went from 49th in fourth grade reading to 9th in fourth grade reading, while Michigan has fallen from a mediocre 32nd to 48th. And they did that simply, Chris, by pushing, requiring every kid learn phonics, requiring that every kid be able to learn, read by the third grade. If a kid struggles, they get the tutor as early as kindergarten, and every school is graded so that every parent, every grandparent, every taxpayer knows how the local school does. And here's the miracle part of it. So it truly isn't a miracle because human beings did it, so that means we can do it. But my severely autistic special ed granddaughter, Savannah, was able to read in the third grade in Mississippi. Mm. I never thought it was possible. That's the magic of the Mississippi Miracle, and there's no reason why we can't recreate that here in Michigan. There's no reason why we can't, we've increased education spending. We're almost a top five state spending. We're certainly a bottom five state in performance. I have another proposal, which I'd love to talk about. Hopefully we can tonight on Wood TV and NBC across the state, which is a requirement that 70% of every school dollar goes in the classroom. That means more dollars for kids directly. That means more dollars for teachers, quite frankly. It means less dollars for administration, which, as you guys probably know, has grown dramatically over the past decade, while student enrollment has fallen off.
Yeah. Mike, the debate also focused heavily on taxes. We talked about that. But, you know, a lot of families are also still struggling with child care and housing and health care and just everyday costs. What would your top priority be to make life more affordable in Michigan if you're elected governor?
Well, Lloyd, thanks for asking that. Because I grew up as the son of a carpenter. My mom was a maid. In the Marines, I had a child and I raised her for most of my 20s. I was a single parent, got a lot of help from my parents. So I had to fight the fights involving childcare and trying to get through school and holding down a job, even despite having veterans benefits. And I know it's a struggle. My brother-in-law, my cousins are still, UAW and skilled trade folks, and it's a struggle. So how do we do that, Lloyd? Well, the one thing I tried to emphasize last night was that, when I was attorney general and Lloyd, you were covering it.
Yes.
I took on utilities and saved ratepayers billions of dollars. I took on Blue Cross when the legislature and the governor wouldn't, at my political peril, saved seniors $700 million and increased Medigap rates. That's the boring but important day in, day out fights that our state needs a governor to take on and be consistent and show up each and every day.
However this thing shakes out, whether it's you or John or Perry that wins this nomination, do you think that the party will unite behind whoever that is?
Yes. Look, I mentioned it last night. I found John his first campaign office in my building. My nephew volunteered for him. I've given him money each and every time. So, of course, if in the odd circumstance he were to get elected, I would, of course, support him. I'm a Republican. But here's the reality. Republican ideas, conservative ideas, are not going to prevail unless we pick a winner in the August primary. And John James and Perry Johnson just have not won. Whether it's pre-Apple days or post-Apple days, they just not have won statewide. And I'm the only one who has.
Yeah. Mike Cox, we always appreciate your time. Thank you. We look forward to talking with you again very, very soon. Thank you.
See you, Mike.
Thank you, Chris. You guys take care.
You as well. You got it. Look, I think that has to be the message here is that, yes, drawing that contrast that you mentioned, obviously that was the case last night.
Yes.
But we need to get to the substance.
Get to the substance, man. It's a lot of other things that people are dealing with, and they want to hear about what you're going to do if you're their governor.
Speaking of these races, on the Democratic Senate race, Abdul El-Sayed has a chance to win because of his courting of young voters. What does that mean for Michigan? We'll talk to Caitlin Buss next on JR Morning. So some of the stuff that Abdul El-Sayed is peddling, like Medicare for all, wealth distribution, free public education, abolishing ICE, all of these things, ending financial support for Israel. These are a lot of the democratic socialist mantras that we've seen talked about amongst many states in the country, and Colorado, New York, even among Graham Platner, who now has dropped out of that main Senate race, which is pretty interesting. But Abdul El-Sayed is doing well. He's polling well because of the work that he's done with young voters in particular. And there has been a shift amongst young voters over the last 10 to 15 years. I still maintain they're a pretty unreliable voting block.
You got to get them out.
But they do seem to be more engaged now than I remember being at that age.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
I was like,
because my friends, man, when I was in high school and stuff, you know, and I was into civics and all of that, you know, and they were like, oh, yeah, whatever, man.
I had other priorities in college. I was.
I bet you did.
I wasn't so engaged politically.
Okay.
But they seem to be more so now.
Yeah, I agree.
And so how does that impact his campaign? How does that change the formula for this race? Caitlin Buss, the assistant editorial page editor at the Detroit News, wrote about it and joins us this morning. Caitlin, good to have you back.
Hey, great to be with you guys.
What type of kind of guerrilla work has El-Sayed done at the ground level to get him in position to where he's at today?
Well, you know, I think it's two things. So I think you're partially right. He's done the groundwork. You know, he ran for governor before. He actually didn't get any traction in that campaign, but obviously it gave him, you know, some on the ground information, some experience. He's had his public health experience before, but I think what's unique about him right now is he did that groundwork at a time where his ideas were far less popular, and now they've become what people are craving, right? And so especially the younger demographic we were talking about, I mean, that's what they want. And so he's met that moment with them. You know, I've had people say, oh, this position isn't socialist or this one isn't socialist. I think the young people are defining what they think democratic socialism is today. And it includes, you know, some of those issue areas I touched on.
One of the more interesting arguments in your piece is that today's younger voters aren't necessarily rejecting the system. They're extending it. Can you kind of unpack that idea?
Yeah. So, you know, for much of my life, and I'm a bit older than these younger voters, right? But for much of my life, that has been the experience as well. I mean, right after I was in college, you know, the financial bailout came, then the auto bailout, then you had, Bernie Sanders won in 2016 here. No one seemed to think that that was maybe a sign of things to come. And then you had Biden win in 2020. You had, Kamala lose in 2024 because of the uncommitted movement, which was really an expression of that progressive ideas coming out. I think that young people have seen government dictate markets. They've seen government be involved with industries that they favor. They've seen government use its power to manipulate the economy. And they're saying, if we can do that for these companies that they favor or whatever, why can't we do it for all of us? Give us free student, you know, get rid of our student debt, give us free health care and fix the housing problem with government power.
How does Michigan factor into all of this as well? Because, you know, you hear the Bernie Sanders argument a lot, and I think it's a fair comparison. Although Bernie Sanders was running in a Democratic primary, how that would have worked, how that would have shaked out in an alternate universe if he was the candidate over Hillary, I don't know, right? I mean, Donald Trump still won the state, but Michigan is a different animal. It's not quite like New York or some of these other more solidly blue states. So how does that play in a general if El-Sayed gets the nomination?
Yeah, and I think Michigan is hard because we have such differences between the urban and rural voters and kind of what they end up prioritizing, and suburbans are, you know, somewhere in the middle. But I think in Michigan, the other thing that's fueling his campaign is first his unique background and his name. You know, I've had national outlets ask, you know, is this going to be a problem for him? And I tend to say I think it's a benefit to him because of Michigan's diversity and the Middle East problem, which touches the Jewish community, you know, all kinds of Middle Eastern communities. He's uniquely positioned to talk to people on that. And so that's a message I think that has resonated, at least in southeastern Michigan. How that plays out state, I think that's where a lot of the competition can come from.
And I'm wondering, too, do you think younger voters are making ideological choices or simply asking, you know, hey, if the government helped corporations, why can't they help just ordinary people? I mean, I'm thinking, like, how much of Abdul El-Sayed's appeal is about his policies and how much is it about his ability to connect with these younger voters who feel like they're left behind economically?
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. His policies, you know, yeah, they're similar to, you know, a lot of, you know, far left candidates. They're nothing particularly special, but he does have a unique way of connecting. And he's run, you know, what I think he's tried to make an authentic campaign. Of course, I still have questions about some of the ways he's presented things or, you know, his policies in general, for sure. But he does try to connect, and he is constantly out there on video. And for anyone who knows, you know, the media landscape, that is where that is where it's all happening. So he's been really smart in that way.
Well, and he's a very engaging person. I mean, if you talk to him in person, there is a presence about him. And that goes a long way when you're out there talking to voters. I'm curious to know how younger voters are looking at him and Haley Stevens head to head. I mean, she is certainly more of the establishment, and it seems like they're pushing back against that.
Yeah, I think I wish I remembered off the top of my head now, but he is definitely leading with younger voters. Haley, it was interesting because when McMorrow was in the race, I think she was actually leading with the older, more established average Democratic voter. So Haley Stevens has had a hard time here the whole time, but she'll pick up, you know, people that McMorrow had in her camp. But I've also seen a lot of the McMorrow people saying they'll go to Abdul. So I think it will continue to be neck and neck. But I think we will see a split, you know, among age groups with how it ends up.
Fascinating stuff. Caitlin Buss, appreciate your piece. Appreciate the time this morning. Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much.
Yeah. You got it. Yeah. But there is, again, I think it's worth noting that Michigan is different.
Totally.
What's happening in New York is not what's happening here.
Purple.
Absolutely.
You know?
And so you get to these places where they are blue Democratic strongholds. Yes. Mm-hmm. That is not Michigan.
No.
And even when you do finally have your candidates that are going to represent on the ballot, how does that play here? What's happening on the national level play into what the messages here,
yes,
amongst these candidates? That's the fascinating part to me.
Mm-hmm.
Really cool stuff. Coming up on the other side, we'll get you caught up on the headlines. 8 o'clock hour coming up. Tigers win yesterday. Justin Verlander,
yay,
going to the All-Star game.
And he's going.
We'll talk to Chris Castellani. Coming up on JR Morning. And it's a beautiful morning here in downtown Detroit. Absolutely.
Boy, it looks good.
Perfect out there today.
It
sun
does.
Shining over the skyline. And feels good.
It does.
For an early June day.
For a Friday Eve.
That's exactly,
yay,
right. Yay! We talked to Mike Cox this morning. If you missed that interview, you can go to WJR.com. Check that out. But the GOP debate on Fox 2 last night, you know, we asked him about the would you wish you could have gotten into a little more? And he said, yes.
Wish you went a little longer.
You know, you asked about the painting the contrast between them and their opponents.
But, yeah.
And he said that's necessary.
Mm-hmm.
That when you have people that are running for the same spot, you got to draw that contrast. Meanwhile, I'd like more steak, less sizzle.
Yeah. And I think because the first time they're all together, you know, I think they had to try to differentiate themselves from each other. But I'm hoping that in other debates, upcoming debates, that we'll get more of the steak and not the sizzle.
Yeah. And again, I think that's the important part to me. Like, I honestly care less about your personality. I care less about, like, even like your history necessarily, to a degree. I mean, we're not looking at Graham Platner.
Right.
Let's just be very clear here.
Yes, right.
But if you have good ideas that you feel like you can galvanize a legislature around, God bless. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be good for the state. I'm all for it. Like, and it's not party specific.
No.
If you have good ideas, then good ideas prevail.
That's it.
Now, we may disagree on
some things. Yeah. But that's normal. That's okay.
But for the most part, if you've got good ideas, I'm all ears. And that's what I want to hear more of.
Yeah.
I want to hear good ideas. Everybody seems to be on board with doing away with the state income tax.
But one thing you did ask, you said if one of the others prevail and not Mike Cox, would he, you know, galvanize around that person? He said, yeah. He said they would unify.
Well, whether that's him, like if he wins, do you expect them to get on board?
Yep,
and if somebody else wins, do you get on board? And the answer is yes. He said yes.
Yeah. I mean, you know, but that's a question we'll ask them all when we get them. I mean, we'll have John James tomorrow and we'll ask him the same question.
Because this is part of the bad blood that you get during these campaigns, these primary runs.
Yeah.
You just throw a little mud around and then you get behind the candidate. I mean, heck, Kamala Harris, when she was running for president, accused Joe Biden of being a racist because of the school bus issues.
System. Yeah, yes.
And she ended up being his vice president. She's like, he's the best. You know. Yeah. So this it happens. It's all part of the
J.D.
game.
J.D. Vance talked about
the
president.
Didn't like Donald Trump.
Yep.
Absolutely. So here you go.
Yeah.
It's all part of the game. And at some point, you have to just that it is what it is.
Yeah.
But let's get to the substance.
Let's get an update on that 5-year-old boy who was shot in the arm by a stray bullet. A 15-year-old boy is now in custody following that shooting. Police say the young boy was riding his bicycle with his father at the Fargo Oakfield playground around 9 o'clock, which is right across the street actually from the young boy's home. He's in front of his house, but it was near that park. That happened Tuesday night around 9 o'clock. Gunfire erupted. The father said he heard 3 gunshots, saw his son fall off the bike. The child had been struck in the arm. It was a through-and-through wound. The bullet, they say, was fired into the air, allegedly by this suspect, this 15-year-old suspect. At the walkabout Wednesday with the Detroit police chief that he does every Wednesday in the communities, he announced that the teen suspect is being held at a juvenile detention center. And the chief, Todd Bettison, credited tips from the public for that quick arrest, calling the community and police an unbeatable team. The 5-year-old, he's recovering. He's said to be in good spirits, and no charges have been filed yet, but they should be forthcoming.
Thank God that kid's okay. I mean,
it could have been much worse. I mean, I mean, he got hit in the arm, stray bullet. It could have hit him somewhere else, very vital, and, you know, he could not be here. So thank God for that. But this 15-year-old who's shooting a gun in a park, you know, hopefully he can get some help too, because something's definitely not right with that person either.
Yeah. Meanwhile, on the Iran front, the president says that the Iranians want to make a deal.
We've already won militarily. They have very little left, and they want to make a deal so badly. They called a little while ago. They want to make a deal so badly. I just don't know if they're worthy of making a deal. I don't know that they're going to honor the deal. That's the problem.
This comes as CENTCOM confirmed that 90 Iranian military targets were hit as part of an operation along the coast of Iran near the Strait of Hormuz. And the president says essentially the ceasefire is over. The memorandum of understanding is over. And so now we're now back to war action here. Oil prices have jumped to $73 a barrel, $75 a barrel this morning. Again, what we saw in the aftermath of the blockade was that Iran was firing at other Gulf countries.
Yes.
Bahrain, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, all of these places, which they did yesterday, excluding Saudi Arabia. But it's isolating Iran from the region, but that doesn't mean the region doesn't want stability. So you're juggling all of these major factors while the president basically says, I'm ready to go in and finish the job in Iran. So it is problematic. Also new this morning, Iraq announcing a new political cooperation and economic partnership with the United States ahead of their prime minister's visit to Washington later this month. They're trying to create basically a bridge between Washington and Tehran. Baghdad is trying to play that role between the United States and Iran and as a mediator of sorts, if you will. So that's new this morning. The IRGC says that warning the world to get out of its Strait of Hormuz, denouncing U.S. adventurism and interference. The IRGC making these comments that foreign powers have, quote, no stake in the Strait of Hormuz, and said U.S. involvement in determining traffic routes through the key would draw a crushing response. That's just not accurate.
That's not.
I mean, it's just not accurate. The foreign nations do have a heavily large stake,
yes,
in the Strait of Hormuz. 20% of the world's oil supply comes through there.
Yeah,
there. So yes, there is a huge stake for everybody in this international waterway.
President Trump says he's going to ask the U.S. Supreme Court to reconsider its ruling blocking his effort to restrict birthright citizenship, a move legal experts say is unlikely to succeed. The Supreme Court rejected the president's executive order last month, ruling it conflicted with the 14th Amendment, which grants citizenship to people born in the United States who are subject to the jurisdiction thereof. Trump called the decision a miscarriage of justice and said he plans to immediately seek a rehearing. The Supreme Court rarely agrees to rehear cases after issuing the decision. It has not done so in a fully argued case in decades. The president issued that executive order on his first day back in office as part of that broader effort to change immigration policy.
And there's an interesting piece in The Hill on this, that it's creating a real headache for John Thune and Mike Johnson, the leaders in both chambers. It's creating a division now. Supreme Court ruled on it. You're not going to create an amendment to the 14th Amendment.
No.
So it feels like this is a push that is unlikely to go far. Yeah. Meanwhile, Justin Verlander has been selected as a special representative for the Tigers for the All-Star game. And this comes as he is a legend pick. This came from Rob Manfred. This is his 10th now All-Star game. And he hasn't pitched more than one game this year. But he's a legend pick. Minutes after that announcement was made, Justin Verlander on social media confirmed that this would be his last season. He never wanted to retire because of a milestone, a number, or a date on the calendar. I wanted the game to tell me when it was time. Over the last several months, I've realized that time has come. So he's hung it up. Here's what he had to say.
You know, just kind of looking at time, the game, how the game's played now, things that I have left to accomplish. And, like, I think the writing kind of was on the wall. As you know, 300 wins, 4,000 strikeouts, those are a few years away. Two maybe really good ones. And even that, like the way the game's played now, I think wins are just getting so much harder and harder to come by.
10-time All-Star.
Yeah.
2-time World Series champ with Houston. AL MVP in 2011. 3-time Cy Young winner. 2-time ERA holder. I mean, the dude is just... And by the way, here's another aspect, Justin Verlander, and Jason, you probably know this. There aren't many workhorses anymore. I mean, Justin Verlander ate up innings and pitched at a high level for a very long time.
Yeah, it's and like that doesn't exist innings, anymore. 5 innings or 100 pitches, you're out of
you're
the game.
You're out.
Sure. You know.
Yeah. And they're making a lot more money than they used to, trying to keep these guys as fresh as possible.
Mm-hmm.
But it kind of feels like the end of an era. We were talking about Max Scherzer a little bit earlier, too. Like, those guys don't exist anymore. They're archaic in the game.
And Scherzer, man, you know, Scherzer would be pitching well, and then he would do something he didn't like. And it seems like he would get an attitude, and then it would just be...
Right, it's over.
It's just done now. Now you don't hit anything.
You look into those different colored eyes, and you're petrified at the play.
Yes, yes.
We'll talk to Chris Castellani on the other side about the Verlander news next on JR Morning.
Michigan summers mean outdoor adventure and fun, but these high temperatures, well, it shouldn't break your budget. Count on Consumers Energy to help you make the most of this season and your budget with tips and ways to save, making small changes like shifting some energy use to the morning or evening, raising your thermostat a couple of degrees, or doing laundry at night or on the weekends. All could help lower your bill while keeping your home comfortable. Discover more ways to beat the heat at consumersenergy.com/summer. Friday on JR Morning, we'll get the latest on the Iran conflict, find out about a new public plaza where you can enjoy the city and hear from the least... Blah, 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 blah. Okay. Friday on JR Morning, we'll get the latest on the Iran conflict, find out about a new public plaza where you can enjoy the city and hear from at least one gubernatorial candidate, all from 6 to 9 a.m. here on WJR, WJR.com, and the always free WJR app.
watching him on the biggest stage, dominate when people expected him to dominate, win awards, throw a no-hitter, pitch in the World Series. Ironically, was warming up in the World Series in Game 7, wondering if he was going to come in to close the game after he had started recently. Those things all will stand out. I'll have a ton of time to walk through memory lane with him and will want to talk through all of those things, you know, at the appropriate time. I can't wait to get him back on the mound and have him pitch again for us and hopefully anchor a win.
It feels like the end of an era. And Justin Verlander has been so good for so long that you almost forget, like, that this is even a possibility. That he could hang it up because he's just been pitching at such a high level for so long.
And maybe that's why he's hanging it up, because it's been a high level for so long and it's taken a toll.
Well, it's taken a toll. It certainly has taken a toll on his body. He just hasn't been able to shake a couple of these injuries this year. Let's talk about him with Chris Castellani at CastellaniContent.com. Chris, it's good to have you back. Were you surprised by this? Have you heard rumblings that maybe this was a possibility?
Not surprised at all. A little bit surprised that it came at this point in this season. You know, I really do believe that Verlander was one of those guys who had, you know, full intention of playing as long as he possibly could. I think he's always enjoyed it. But I went back and I looked last night, and this is a guy who's had, I think, 8 seasons, maybe 9 seasons, where he's made 30 starts or more. And he's had about 3 or 4 other seasons where he's made 28 starts. This is somebody who has taken the ball every fifth day his entire career. And I think that, well, obviously physically you look at the injuries. I think that it's taken a toll on him mentally, not being able to be out there. And I think when you have a guy like him who has performed at the highest level for as long as he did, I think once you reach a point where you're unable to know when your next start is going to be, I think that really started to take a toll on him. So I'm not surprised at all that he is retiring. I thought once he signed here, there was a chance that we could get this announcement that this was going to be his final season. I didn't think that it would happen during the season, though.
I know Verlander said he's been, like, plugging holes in the boat, you know, with one injury after another. Is that a feeling that a lot of aging athletes eventually confront?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's the old adage, right? Father Time's undefeated. I mean, Verlander, his entire career defied the odds in terms of how he took care of his body. And the truth is, we're never going to see another guy like him. I mean, this is somebody who at his peak was, you know, pitched over 250 innings. I mean, we're lucky at this point if we see anyone in baseball pitch over 200 in a season, you know, and he pitched 50 more than that. I think that he took such great care of his body longer than almost any other pitcher of his era, pitched into his 40s. But, you know, it's eventually, and I think all great athletes kind of talk about this. Sometimes, you know, in football, you take that one hit.
Yeah.
Baseball, you suffer that one injury, and you're just a little bit slower to come back after every single start after that. And I think that's just kind of where Verlander found himself.
You talk about the pitchers of his era. Where does he rank, do you think?
Oh, man, if he's not number one, he's number two. I mean, it's there, even in the time in which he played, you know, I feel like the way that we valued and kind of judged starting pitchers definitely changed. I mean, I think in terms of longevity, obviously he's number one. I put him ahead of Scherzer. I know obviously there's the Tigers connection there, but each with 3 Cy Youngs. I think Verlander, you know, a little bit with the multiple no-hitters, and I think the fact that he reinvented himself multiple times. You know, he's in that kind of triad there with him, Scherzer, and obviously Kershaw, who went, you know, about a decade where he wasn't giving up any runs. But I really think that Verlander of the three, or really of anybody, will stand the test of time as much as anybody, just given the sheer number of innings he pitched. And you're looking at somebody who, you know, made 35 starts in a year, in a season one time, a guy who won 24 games, a guy who was kind of the last of his kind doing things that pitchers just aren't expected to do anymore, and also had some pretty important moments in the postseason. So, you know, he's one of the great ones that ever lived.
You know, Chris, some Tigers fans I know still wonder, what if he had never been traded to Houston? How different might both his career and the Tigers' history, what would it have been, you know?
It's strange to think about, because I think that when we look back on the last decade of Tiger baseball. In a lot of ways, there was Verlander era, and then there was the post Verlander era. And look, for people that kind of, you know, forget, because it was 9 years ago now, you know, this was a trade that was initially vetoed, and you know, he was hesitant about going to Houston, and obviously things changed for his career and things changed for the Tigers once he agreed to go there. I mean, I think that as frustrating as it was to trade him, when I look back at where the Tigers were at that time, I think that it was unfortunately necessary. The Tigers had built up some kind of bad habits in terms of not really building up much of a farm system, and the major league product was full of guys that were, you know, the payroll had gotten way too high. Like, it was sort of the perfect time. But
yeah,
you do wonder. I think that at the same time, though, what people forget is if you didn't trade him, I think that he had 1.5 years left on his contract. I want to believe that, you know, as much as he loved it here, given where the Tigers were at, I think it was kind of inevitable that mm-hmm. there was going to be an exit at some point. But the Tigers just made that decision a lot easier.
You look at his repertoire, his career, and what he was able to accomplish. The AL MVP in 2021, he had the three Cy Young Awards, two-time World Series winner with Houston, the Triple Crown, the All-Star appearances, the ERA title holders. Bob Nightingale says he believes that there's a chance here that Justin Verlander would be a unanimous first ballot Hall of Famer. Is that something that you believe too?
Yeah, I actually had a small little tweet thread about this yesterday, because, like, to me, and I normally don't look at things this simplistically, but, like, if you don't think Justin Verlander's a Hall of Famer, you probably shouldn't have a vote. Like this is silliness. But I, unfortunately, a lot of this stuff is unanimous. Not every guy makes their votes public. And I feel like we've seen this. We saw, you know, Griffey was not unanimous. There was there's only been one unanimous guy, and it was Mariano Rivera. Mm-hmm. Jeter, not unanimous. Verlander should be 100%. Right. My prediction, and this is just pure speculation on my part, is there's going to be somebody who is going to punish him for being on those Astros teams that got caught for the sign stealing. Even though he was not a hitter, he did not benefit from that necessarily. His numbers did not benefit from that, you know, and still put up some of the best numbers of his career, winning two Cy Youngs in Houston. All it takes is one guy.
Right.
And I would imagine somebody is going to have that kind of self-righteous mindset. But to me, I mean, there's not a single box that he doesn't check off. And really, he could have retired 5 years ago, and I think there wasn't a single box that he didn't check off. I mean, you could argue he had a Hall of Fame prime two different teams, which is crazy stuff.
Exactly. Chris Castellani, appreciate it. Thank you.
Of course. Thank you, guys.
Yep, more next. All right, this segment requires your participation. 800-859-0957, 800-859-0WJR. Oh, we'll get the panel's perspective. But I think you are one of two people. Because I am one of two people.
Okay.
So, you know, we just concluded our move. Mm-hmm. Well, that's not true. The first part of our move. We've moved back in with my parents.
Uh-huh.
If you could, I'd appreciate it. Just say a little prayer before you go to bed every night. I'd appreciate that. Sorry, Mom. Anyway, so we just finished this first part of our move. So we closed on the house this week. Woo, everything's good. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, something has suffered during this. And I blame it on the move, although it has nothing to do with the move, because I do this all the time.
It would have suffered without the move.
It would have suffered without the move.
Okay.
But I'm blaming it on this unique set of circumstances.
Okay.
I need new tires.
Uh-huh.
And my car is shaking so badly.
Chris.
Because I'm basically skating down the lodge in my truck.
Especially when it rains and stuff. I'm sure you're sliding.
It's a mess.
Yeah.
I needed an oil change last week. I let my oil life get down to 2%.
Chris.
If I need new windshield wipers, I wait till it's basically smearing water and not taking it off.
Just bug juice all
just,
over.
Just, it's
everywhere.
It's a disaster zone on my windshield.
Oh, my God.
I wait till the very last minute to do almost anything with my car. Here's another example.
Okay.
I need gas. Gas light's got to be on.
Come on, Chris.
My kids, you think my windshield's a nightmare. the back seat of my truck looks like a war zone.
But you got kids. I get that.
But they're disgusting human beings.
You hear this, Jason?
Smears on my window. I got French fries in the back, cookie crumbs everywhere.
We all got a French fry in our car somewhere.
They're disgusting. Hello. They're disgusting. So my question is, are you somebody that is proactive in your vehicle maintenance? Or do you wait until the very last minute? 800-859-0957.
Now, can I throw this in here real quick?
Sure.
And you guys are going to think I'm nuts.
Okay.
But even in the summertime, I will make sure my gas tank is above half. And I know you're supposed to do that in the wintertime. I have blown a fuel pump way back when. And I just got into that routine. I'm like, oh, I just can't let my gas tank get below half.
I don't even do it then.
And I used to be bad with the oil changes.
Lloyd has never judged me so hard than this.
But you know what's really good though? You're talking about tires. Now you can just make an appointment, and they're always good about their appointments. Like, I'll go to Discount Tire, and you're not waiting too long.
Exactly.
So you get online, you make an appointment. I know you got a lot going on right now.
Well, okay, go ahead, because I got a tire story too. Go ahead.
No, but for me, for my own car, I'm a little proactive because I don't know what it is. You know, if I see the gas light come on, it irritates me and I get irritated. And it's like, why did I let it get that far? That's number one. Then when I get my oil change, I get the 5,000 mile and they put the sticker up there and it says, you know, either this month or this many miles. When it gets past, when I look down and I say, oh God, I'm past my miles, it irritates me. I'm irritated until I go and get the oil change to get it done. Now, for my wife's car, I'm really proactive with her because, you know, all she's going to do is put gas in it. But, you know, oil changes, tire rotations, tires, I make sure, especially because she has the grandkids in her car a lot, and I can't afford to have her sliding all over the freeways and stuff with the kids in the car.
Renee, who are you? Okay.
Really? Okay. Yeah,
Just make sure it's in the summer, not in the winter.
Exactly. Wow.
Brian, the co-host of the car show, is judging me very hard. I can see it. The contempt coming from the glass is palpable.
Here's why you need to keep gas in your car.
Okay.
And I've learned this working on the car show. The gas in your tank cools the fuel pump. So if the gas gets too low, fuel pump overheats, and if they when that fuel pump goes out, Chris, it's not like something under the hood. They got to pull the gas tank off.
Oh, it is.
You might as well be speaking Mandarin to me.
That scares me. That's why I keep the gas in my car.
I know.
It will take a lot of money out of your pocket.
Yeah,
is what I'm telling you.
That makes more sense.
It may sound like Mandarin, but you know what that money is.
Yeah, right.
That money is American.
Well, and you know what's going to happen.
Hey, you know where we were.
Is when I need that new fuel pump, I'm going to go, why is this happening to me?
Of course you are.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's bad. It's actually, like, insane.
And
it's insane
like you,
behavior.
Chris. I'm with you. My gas stays. My gas gets low, it drives me crazy. Got to have my gas because I got to get to work.
Yeah.
Oil changes, it starts bothering me, but I was like, well, I can't go today. I can't today. I'm busy today.
Uh-huh.
But so I'll let it slide 1,000 miles.
But it irritates you, though.
Literally,
but it does bother me.
Yeah. Literally, this morning, I drove around yesterday knowing I needed gas.
Mm-hmm.
I knew I needed gas. I was under a quarter tank.
Okay. Why didn't you stop?
Doing around, got a bunch of stuff to do, blah, blah, blah. This morning, I get in and the light's on.
Stop being so rebellious, Chris.
Why didn't you just stop?
That's a great question. I don't know. Because, because I'm not... I'm not okay.
Look, Renee, maybe you guys need a dad. Clearly, you didn't learn anything from yours.
Does your car tell you how many miles to empty?
Yes. So I'm like, I got 8 miles. I'm good. I can get to the gas station.
Yeah. That's a game I don't want to play.
I know that's right. That's chicken, man. You're playing chicken now.
But so like, we're members to both Costco and Sam's Club.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Right? So I'm like, oh, I'm going to save a couple bucks.
Sure. Yep.
And I'm going to go and get tires from Sam's. They had the tires that I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
So I put the order in, and I had to reschedule the first one, and they're like, good, because the tires aren't in anyway. Perfect.
Oh, see. Yeah.
Then I rescheduled.
Okay.
I show up for my tire deal,
uh-huh.
and they go, oh, tires aren't here. We have to reschedule again. I go, you know what? You could take this order and put it where the sun don't shine.
Bleep, bleep, bleep.
I didn't say that. The lady was very nice. Yeah. But I'm like, why didn't you call me? So now I tried to save a couple bucks. Didn't work. And now I have to go somewhere else. I'm going today. Because I don't, they might just explode on the lodge on the way home. So I gotta go get tires somewhere. Who's got them?
Yeah.
And I gotta go do that. But I am. So who are you? Are you wait till the last second like me, or are you proactive like Lloyd, or at least tries to be? 800-859-0957, 800-859-0WJR. I think, unfortunately, there are a lot of people like me out there.
And there's the last piece of dad advice, Renee. The way we
go,
all
talk
drive,
to Renee.
The way all of us drive,
take her to church, Brian.
Driving, the city driving, that is considered severe driving. It is harder on your car than just getting on the freeway and like driving to Ohio or Tennessee. Well, I mean severe mechanically, not severe mentally.
Renee. Oh, okay.
So it's more important to take care of your car the way we all drive it around. It's what I've learned. I'm not lecturing. I'm just trying to share my
knowledge. Getting a lot of flack for my messy car from my kids. They say they learn it from the parents. LOL. Clean it up, Chris.
Oh, yeah.
Oh. Make them clean it up.
I found.
Yeah. Jason, right. I should make them clean it up.
Let me tell you, Marie, when she has the grandkids and they have all kind of stuff, she looks in the back. She was like, get all of that stuff out of the back seat
right
now.
Well, I would like her to come to my house because they don't listen to me.
I turned in our last car. I went in to clean it up before we bought the new car. And Bev's out helping me clean. And I went, what is this? This is the weirdest shaped rock I've ever seen. And I said, look at this. Look at that. I don't even know what this is. And she goes, it's a French fry that's been in there probably as long as we've owned the car.
Oh, my
it
God.
Was, I couldn't break it. It was so hard.
Oh, it became a weapon.
Yeah. It's like, what? That's a French fry? Oh,
well, it was.
At one time.
From a 586 number on the text, I tell people that the steel cords are showing on their tires, and they go, I know, and they drive off.
That's really bad.
That might be where I'm at. I don't know.
Oh, God. Chris, get the tires, man.
Lloyd, you might be doing the show solo tomorrow.
I'm telling you.
Well, I'm just praying I get to the tire place today.
See, that's what I worry about. It's not that I'm going to run out of gas. It's where. I'm not going to run out of gas in my driveway or my street. It's going to be on the lodge.
No place convenient. No place convenient. Except
somewhere dangerous.
Yeah.
A new initiative focused on expanding early access to early language, literacy, and family support programs. Hopefully they teach these kids when to put gas in their car and change their tires as well. That's coming up next on JR Morning. Well, a new partnership with Gardner White and the Children's Foundation of Michigan has been announced today, and it's called Bring It Home for Kids. It is a new campaign to help address early language learning and family support programs during some of the formidable years, and both Gardner White and the Children's Foundation doing so much for our community and for our little ones. And Rachel Stewart, the CEO of Gardner White, and Andrew Stein, the president and CEO of the Children's Foundation of Michigan, both join us this morning. It's good to talk with you both.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. Andrew, let's start with you. How important is this, and how important is it to have partners like Gardner White work together to make sure that you're addressing these really important needs for kids?
Well, thanks for having us. We're so excited to announce this today. This is hugely important. At the Children's Foundation of Michigan, we think about the health and well-being of kids across our state every day. And to get kids off to a strong start early in their life, in these critical years of 0 to 5, that's when 90% of brain development happens. And so this partnership with Gardner White is going to allow us to raise resources that are going to get out to programs everywhere there's a Gardner White footprint, supporting programs that are helping to build those early language skills, those early literacy skills, which we know isn't always happening. It usually isn't happening in schools. It's happening in homes, on sofas, in bed with your kids. And so we're going to use this money to get out to programs that are helping build those early literacy, early language skills, and getting kids off to a strong start.
And Rachel, you know, people might be surprised to see a furniture retailer partnering with the Children's Foundation. But, you know, how did this partnership come about, and what inspired Gardner White to get involved?
So I think, down, it's part of our DNA that we think our responsibility extends well beyond the homes we furnish and well into the communities we serve. And I think, you know, we are all about families. And if you look at the data, this is one of the most important ways you can really invest in families. And then I think we really want to focus what we do in the community. I think we want to partner with great organizations like Andrew. We certainly don't have the answers. We know how to sell furniture, but we want to partner with great organizations that really over time through long-term partnerships are going to have meaningful impact in our communities.
And so every time somebody comes into Gardner-White now through August 4th, a bit of those proceeds will go towards this new program.
Yep, they will. We've committed a minimum of $500,000, but of course, you know, who wants to focus on the minimum? You know, I'd really like to make this succeed and make it an annual thing with 7-year donations that can have a real impact throughout our state.
Andrew, when we talk about early language and literacy, you know, a lot of people immediately think about schools, but are parents and caregivers really a child's first teachers?
Absolutely. And that's how these proceeds, a portion is going to go to support those programs that are coaching parents and caregivers on how to be those first teachers in the home, right? Anyone who has young children or has been a part of raising young children, it's so critical that you're surrounding kids with access to language, talking to kids, reading to kids. And we want to use this partnership to help support the programs that are equipping parents and caregivers to be really those first educators in the home.
And Andrew, we've seen the numbers, you know, we're seeing less kids at reading level in third grade. We're obviously in the political landscape, we're hearing a lot about education, but when you're looking at kids this young, and you talked about that 90% of their brain development is happening in these critical stages, having that access, more access for parents at the corporate level is really important too, because you're accessing a whole other funding source that maybe you wouldn't traditionally have to help more.
Yeah, and this really speaks to Rachel and Gardner White. I mean, they're a furniture company in our state, but Rachel and their team want to solve problems. And this is one of the most effective and upstream ways to address education across our state, which is to get in early and start to build these skills that get kids on the right track in literally from day one. And so that speaks to Rachel and team wanting to be really thoughtful and strategic on how they can have the greatest impact.
And Rachel, we often...
Well, and I would say, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I would say that, I mean, K-12 is critically important. I mean, there is a ton of conversation that we are very much involved in there. And I mean, I think you have to look no farther than Mississippi and the Mississippi miracle with Carrie Wright to know their solutions. But I think there's a lot of people focusing on that. And we can solve this. That's something we can solve. We see less action, and as Andrew's pointing out, in this 0-5 space, which is why we wanted to be there, because one can't be successful without the other.
And Rachel, we often hear about workforce development and growing Michigan's economy. Is investing in early childhood one of the smartest economic investments we can make?
There's a reason whenever anyone talks about economic development, it starts with a conversation about education, and always, every single conversation goes back to education, because it's really one and the same. And we need desperately to grow our economy and really grow our population. It's not going to happen without our kids doing better.
It's very cool. You also have the Celebrate the Best of Michigan, which is a part of this campaign. And people can go to gardner-white.com/children's-foundation, and you can submit this online entry there, because there's a ton of different sweepstakes and experiences for people. Lion season tickets, VIP access to America's Thanksgiving Parade presented by Gardner White, the Detroit Grand Prix VIP experience. Mm-hmm. So there's another incentive for people to get involved here too, aside from just coming in to buy some new furniture.
Oh, we made this as fun and sexy as possible.
Yeah. Well, it's a lot of fun, and there's a lot of fun for people in
Definitely.
There. Rachel Stewart, God bless you. Thank you for helping out in all of these ways that you do and continue to do and have done in the past. Thank you for that. And Andrew Stein at, of course, the Children's Foundation of Michigan. We appreciate you both so much for taking this on. Thank you.
Have a great day.
Yeah. Very cool.
Great stuff, man. I mean, we need all the help we can get. And when you have, you know, corporations and companies coming together with these places like the Children's Foundation. I mean, it's a win-win.
But it's awesome. And again, this is like part of our DNA now.
It is.
Like all of these companies are helping, you know, these different outlets to further our community. To make us better.
These are going to be future workers.
It is not like that in other places.
No.
You don't get that all the time.
Mm-mm.
So it's the fact that it's become almost the norm, and Gardner White is in the middle of a lot of this.
Oh, man.
But
they are a fabric in the community.
Literally.
Yes.
Literally. Absolutely fantastic. All right, that's going to do it for us today. Kevin Dietz and Altuck coming your way next here on WJR. We'll see you tomorrow on a Friday.